ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय।
Thank you very much for taking your precious time and joining us this evening. Tonight I was asked to speak on the subject of how to find peace in an age of chaos. Of course, I do not think that any of you are in need of much convincing that this is an age of chaos. Today, when we read the news, we find practically 99% bad news. We find terrorism, we find war, violence, crime, disease, drug addiction, alcoholism, various forms of greed, exploitation. Now, sometimes it is described that this society of ours is like a body. It is a social body. Now, a doctor must first diagnose according to the symptoms of the disease, what is the cause of that disease? Within our society today, sometimes we find that by social, medical, or other philanthropic devices, we can make some solution to the chaos in this world. Just like, for instance, recently I was in the United States of America, and while I was there, the news came that they were going to open up the wall in Berlin, in Germany. And people were celebrating all over America, because you know, America is very proud of being the guide in the world for freedom. And of course, it is the primary proponent in the world against communism. So this was considered a very symbolic, positive, auspicious appearance in this world. The Berlin Wall, when I was young, when they first erected it in the 1960s, it was front page news in every newspaper in America. It was considered the greatest atrocity. And to the degree something is causing disturbance, to that degree, there is great reason for rejoicing and celebrating when it is dismantled. So, is this really the end of the problem? Political systems are constantly changing. At the end of World War II, that was called the war that ended all wars, and there was great rejoicing. There was great rejoicing in my country at the end of World War I. They thought, now everything is all right. There was also the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, the American-Mexican War. There's always wars in this world. And even though there is a temporary appearance that there is a cure, unless we understand what is the disease that has caused that problem in the first place, there's no solution. I remember our spiritual master, His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, when he was in New York City for the first time in 1966. He was standing in front of the United Nations building with some of his new disciples. And there he looked up and he saw so many flags waving in the wind. And he commented that they are talking about United Nations. He said, but however many flags there are, that many nations are disunited. And all of their endeavors for peace, there's still violence, hate, and politics that are meant for destruction throughout the world. Because these men do not understand what is the reason for chaos. Factually, even though the wall has come down in Berlin, I guarantee you with 100% certainty that every single person on the east side of the wall and on the west side of the wall is going to have to grow old, get diseased, and die. And that is a chaotic, miserable situation. Therefore, Lord Sri Krishna describes in Bhagavad Gita, Mamu Petya Punarjanma Dukalayam Ashashvatam. This means that this material world is a place of chaos and misery by nature. Why? Because everything here is temporary. By the force of time, everything is in the process of destruction. Time is terrorizing everyone's life. From the moment you are born, your heart starts beating, actually at the time of conception, there's life. And then the heart starts to beat, and with every beat of the heart, with every tick of the clock, the power of time is usurping your duration of life. Even at the times of peace and freedom in a nation, everyone has to face this ultimate conclusion of life, old age, disease, and death. Krishna describes in Gita, it is due to the temporary nature of this world that there can be no real happiness, there can be no real peace, as long as we are identifying ourselves simply as a product of this material existence. Therefore, if we want to find peace, we have to diagnose the real problem, and that is that we are identifying ourselves as being composed of temporary, dying, material elements. Bhagavad Gita describes that we are not this body, but we are the eternal soul. The soul is eternal, it is full of knowledge, and it is full of bliss. Because the soul is full of bliss, the soul is constantly looking for unlimited bliss or happiness, peace. But when the soul is trying to find peace or pleasure through a temporary vehicle that is destined to grow old, get diseased, and die, what real peace can we find? What real happiness can we share with another? We are talking about the inevitable. But some of us may say, but this is a long way ahead of us. We are still young. We are still strong. Let us enjoy now. There's nothing to fear. But the ways of this world is everything is uncertain. You can make so many guarantees through your insurance agents and so on and so forth, that everything will be provided, that you are protected. But really, how much can you protect yourself in this world? Recently, I was driving in a car, and I was driving with one friend, and he told me that just that morning, one of his best friends, who was only 27 years old, he was in very good health. He had asthma since he's been a little boy. He had an asthmatic attack, and within 20 minutes he was dead, and nobody could do anything to help him. Absolutely least expected thing in that person, his friends, or family's lives. How uncertain this world is. So then I was thinking, well, this person had asthma. So there's some possible way that he could die at any minute. So we can say it was expected. He had some physical disorder. But then, just as I was saying that, the car in front of us stopped very suddenly, and our driver was inattentive, and we were this far from smashing into the car and going through the windshield. I was thinking, my God, just driving in a car, we are probably 1,000 times more susceptible to unexpected death than someone who has a disease, even if it's a chronic disease, even if it's a terminal disease. What to speak of walking down the street? This world is full of uncertainties, and the fact is you can never change the condition of this world. We can make so many arrangements to change or adjust the environment, and we must, as far as possible, create an environment that is conducive to peace, prosperity, and happiness. But ultimately, this environment is beyond our control. Therefore, an intelligent man, rather than simply trying to adjust the environment, he tries to adjust his own consciousness in such a way. If flies like me, I should like them also, correct? At least somebody likes me. You know, in this world, you know, affection is hard to come by. So, the environment of our society, we are working so hard to change it. But the real solution is we have to change ourselves. We have to learn how to live harmoniously within this environment. And for this reason, the process of self-realization has been accepted by great saintly persons, by great philosophers, by great persons of various religions throughout history. Now you may ask, when you're talking about trying to make peace in this world, please don't talk about religion. Because most of the violence in this world and terrorism is based on religion. Huh? Just here in India, Muslims and the Hindus, my God, at any second, it's like gasoline. If the slightest spark falls on it, it just explodes. Huh? And the Sikhs and the Hindus, and the Hindus and the Buddhists, there's fighting, violence, terrorism. In previous times, fighting had some honor, like we read in the Mahabharata about this great fight between the Kurus and the Pandavas. It was a very great war, but there was no terrorism in that war. The armies, they agreed on the policies of fighting. They went way off to the battlefield of Kurukshetra, where there was no women, no children, no old people, no civilians. And they were all armed, they all had equal strength, and they said, all right, now let's fight, and let's fight with honor and integrity. And whoever wins can control the world as king, and whoever loses, they will go to heaven. That was their belief. That was what the scriptures say, because they died in the battlefield in an honorable way. Huh? But now, my God, the last place the warriors want to go is a battlefield. They blow up airplanes, huh? They put bombs and buses and cinema houses where women, children, and completely unarmed people are sitting. And most of the terrorism in this world is in the name of religion. But really, does it have anything to do with religion? It has to do only with sectarianism and ignorance. Real religion is universal. According to the Srimad Bhagavatam, it describes that religion is based on four principles. These four principles are called the four pillars of religion. And they are austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness. Whether you call yourself a Hindu or a Muslim or a Buddhist or a Jew or a Christian or a Zoroastrian or a Sikh, this is not so important. The real question and the real message to answer the question is, how are you developing your love of God through the process of following these four principles? Actually, our spiritual master, he suggested that in a sectarian government, the government should give all facility to anyone to follow the religion of their choice and not interfere. But each religion propounds very strongly austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness. And the law must protect those religious principles by any means. And by following these four principles, we can realize in truth, through direct experience, the eternal blissful nature of the soul, and we can realize our eternal relationship with the Supreme Creator, and then we can factually live harmoniously in any condition that the environment puts before us and remain peaceful. And remain an actual well-wisher and contributor to the peace and well-being of society. So tonight, let us discuss these four principles of religion. First, there is austerity. Austerity means to be willing to accept inconvenience for the purification of one's heart and in the service of God and in the service of humanity. Unless one is willing to accept sacrifice or inconvenience, nothing great can be accomplished in life. People take religion to be so cheap, oftentimes. When it comes to making money to provide for oneself and family, one is willing to accept tremendous sacrifice. It's like some of our guests this evening, I see they are doctors. Perhaps they had to go, I know in America, at least 8 to 12 years of medical school to become a doctor. And it's very highly competitive, and you practically have no time for anything. You just have to study, 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 and then the exams come, and you're completely in anxiety about these exams. But because you want to have the profession and the money of a doctor, you're willing to go through so much sacrifice. And then, of course, when you become a doctor, my God, people are calling you at all hours of the night. You have to deal with so many situations that are very difficult. Just yesterday, I was on the train, going from one part of Bombay to the next, and I could see that, my God, just to earn some money, how much inconvenience people are going through, standing in these trains where you're just being, people are punching you and your elbows are going in your eyeballs and people are stepping on you and you're practically being forced off the train onto the tracks. Every day, sometimes for an hour every day, in the morning and evening, people are just standing like this, just... Does anyone like that? No, but because they have to feed their family, they're willing to do it. They're willing to do anything for that. So much austerity. Some people say that spiritual life is very difficult. But life is very difficult. The question we have to ask is not whether something is difficult or not, but whether something is right or not. If something is true, we should be willing to do anything and give everything for that purpose. We've been talking about mostly men, how much they have to undergo just to support their family, how much tribulation, sacrifice, and inconvenience, how many things they have to accept that they don't like. But what about the women? My God. A woman becomes pregnant. You know what it's like for what an inconvenience it is to have this baby living in your body? The women, they know better than me. But they tell me, so I have some idea. First of all, this baby is kicking. The woman can hardly do anything. And then birth. You know how difficult birth is? It's utterly painful. Usually the woman just wants to scream in agony. Practically every woman, after she gives birth, she says, "I'll never have another child." Of course, the nature of the mind is to forget. But I know one friend of mine, she has 14 children. And I remember the first one, she said, "So painful, such an austerity, I'll never have another child." And then after the second one, she said, "Now I'm completely convinced I'll never have another child." And after the third one, she said, "My God, it was worse than ever. I'll never have another child." Of course, after about the 10th one, nobody believed her anymore. Well, she has 14 and she's still running. But it's a very painful experience. But is the misery over when the child is born? You're thinking, relief. Now I can be happy that this big baby is now out of my womb. And now the pain of birth is finished forever. Now I can be happy. Let me go to sleep. Oh my God, I have to wake up. I have to change its diapers. I have to clean its body. I have to feed it. It's screaming at all hours of the day. It's running around. It's breaking everything in the house. It's making a complete embarrassment out of everything. Very difficult. The job of a mother is incredibly difficult. But does the mother think, "Well, I won't do it. It's too difficult. I will not do it. It's tough. It's difficult. Forget it. Let the child die." Some mothers do that. And those mothers are considered the most cruel-hearted, demoniac species on earth. If a mother cannot love its own child, even in the animal world, the mothers love their children. Even a cow, an innocent animal, who has no human brain, she will protect her calf with her life. And if someone comes and takes away the calf, she'll cry tears from her eyes because she loves that calf. And you'll find that in practically every species of life. How degraded can human civilization be where even the mother has no affection or love for the child? Because why? Because it's just too much trouble to raise it. A mother will raise her child. She'll stay up all hours of the night. She'll accept so much inconvenience. Just like I know one lady, she wanted to come very much to this program tonight, but she has a baby, she couldn't come. There's so many things you can't do when you have a baby. But because it's right, you do it. Anything valuable, anything great in this world, you have to accept tribulation and you have to accept pain and inconvenience to take care of that and to attain that. Now, what is the greatest attainment in life? What is the most precious treasure in life? It is the realization of one's eternal soul. It is the fulfillment of all one's heart's desire. To reawaken our eternal love of God. That is the purpose of religion. We are not talking about a sectarian idea. We are talking about loving God and loving all living beings who are part of Him. Now, to achieve that love, why do we take it so cheap? Oh, it's difficult. Therefore, I won't do it. I don't have time. Huh? The most petty things in life, we're willing to endure pain. But when it comes to the greatest thing, we take it so cheaply. Austerity means to be willing to accept inconvenience, sacrifice, and even pain for the purpose of purifying our consciousness in the service of God. In every religion, we find fasting. This is one type of austerity. In the Christian world, they have many days where they fast. There is the period of Lent, where they fast for 1 week. In the Jewish tradition, there is Yom Kippur, where from sunrise to sunset, you must fast, eat nothing. In the Islamic faith, there is the Ramadan, where for 1 month, you fast every day from sunrise to sunset. In the Hindu society, on days like Janamastami, Ram Navami, many people who are sincere, twice a month on Ekadasi, they fast. Huh? On the appearance days of great saints and great avatars, there's fasting. So we find that this principle of austerity is common in every religion. The names may be different, why they're fasting, but the purpose is the same. To show the Lord that you're willing to make some sacrifice to purify your heart for His sake. Regular fasting not only makes the body healthy, not only does it increase the abundance of food grains in the society, but it also teaches one how to become detached from the longings and cravings of the body. I remember when I was studying Islam, one of the reasons Muhammad gave for fasting was because the rich people, they generally have no mercy for the poor people because they've never suffered like the poor. But if you have to fast, then you know what hunger is like. And when you know what hunger is like yourself, then you'll actually feel for somebody who's hungry. And it makes you a compassionate person. So, sometimes there's spiritual practices of rising early, chanting the names of God, giving up sinful activities. It may be an inconvenience. Some of us are very much addicted to watching nonsense things on television or nonsense things in the cinemas. My God, in India, you're really catching up to us Americans as far as degraded cinemas. I think you may be a little ahead. I don't know. I never go to see them. I can only tell by the billboards. The billboards are definitely ahead of ours. What's in the movie theater? I'll be honest with you, I don't know. But these things may be very enjoyable. But the question, is it conducive to our self-realization or is it destructive to our self-realization? Austerity means to accept things favorable for the purification of our heart and to reject things unfavorable for the purification of our heart, whether we like it or not. If we're not willing to say no to the things we like in pursuance of the truth, then you are not worthy of the truth. Human life is meant for sacrifice. The animals, they are simply whatever their senses and mind tell them they enjoy. But human beings are meant to sacrifice for a higher cause. And that is the highest cause, devotion to God. We follow four principles: no illicit sex, no intoxication, no meat eating, no gambling. Sometimes we like these things. Doesn't matter. if these things further implicate me in the laws of karma, the laws of action and reaction, if they impede my progress on the spiritual path, we should be willing to say no. And to accept positive things in God's service, like going to the temples, offering the prayers, chanting the names of God, doing the puja, giving in charity. These things, whether they're difficult or not difficult, doesn't make any difference. They must be done if we want to achieve the goal. So we have to stop taking our religion so cheaply. We have to understand that we have to work, we have to give up, we have to accept pain for this highest purpose of life, for God. We'll do it for ourselves, we'll do it for everyone else, but when it comes to God, if it's perfectly convenient, my dear Lord, and everything's just the way I like it, then I'll go to church, then I'll go to synagogue, then I'll go to the temple, then I will do my puja. But if there's any difficulty, then I just don't have time. This is an austerity. Austerity means making priorities in your time. How much time are you dedicating to purifying your heart for God? How much time are you allocating to your business, to your family? You have to balance everything so your life is full, both materially and spiritually. There has to be a balance, and that is an austerity. Sacrificing time every day with a vow to dedicate it for the purification of your heart through meditation, through japa, through reading of the scriptures. That is the greatest austerity. The second principle of religion is cleanliness. It is said cleanliness is next to godliness. Cleanliness means for the body and the mind. For the body, cleanliness, we should bathe at least once a day. Because if your body is dirty, if your environment is dirty, it's very difficult for your mind to be clean. In Vedic culture, the Brahmins, they would bathe at least 3 times a day before chanting their Gayatri mantra. So by bathing with water, we clean this body, which in fact is God's temple. The body is the temple of God. It is not our body. This is a great illusion to think anything is mine. Krishna says in Gita, Bhoktaram Jagatapasam Saravalokamaheshwaram. This means that everything within this entire creation and beyond is the property of God. And everything is meant to be utilized for His service. So we are saying this is my body, but proprietorship means you have control. Huh? Just like, I'll have to use the example of America, because in India it doesn't apply so much. I'll tell you why. In America, if you have proprietorship over something, no one can take it away from you legally. Huh? Just like if I own an apartment building, I can let somebody use that apartment, but if I don't want that person there anymore, I say you get out, and he has 30 days to get out, and there's nothing you can do. That person may be using the apartment, but because he doesn't own it, he has to get out when he's told to get out. Now in India, my God, with squatters' rights, you're better if you don't own something. Isn't that the way it works here? Possession is 99% of proprietorship. But realistically, if we own something, we have control of that thing. Now, we are calling this body ours. Do any of us want to grow old? Do any of us want to get diseased? Do any of us want to die? It is forced upon us. therefore we are not the proprietors of this body. It is time which is consuming our life's duration. It is through the power of time that we are evicted from this body. We are told, get out at a certain stage. So time is the real proprietor or controller or owner of this body. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, time I am. In this material world, God manifests himself as all-powerful, all-devouring time. Therefore, Krishna or God, whatever name you want to call, in Bhagavad Gita, Lord Sri Krishna says, I am the proprietor of everything. And everything, mayadhyakshena prakriti suyate sacharacharam hetu nanana konteya jagad viparivaratate. Krishna says this material nature is working under my control. And everyone is forced to act helplessly according to the laws of material nature. So therefore, this body is a temple of God. Krishna also says in Gita, Ishvara sarva bhutanam hridesya junatishtati. That I am living in the heart of every living being. If God is in your heart, any residence that God is living is considered a temple, is it not? Some people ask, why do you put this tilak on your head? It's to designate that we are accepting that this body is God's temple. After all, when you walk down the street, there's a cloth merchant and he has his shop, and there is a brass merchant and he has his shop, and there's a restaurant and they have their shop, and there's a hotel, they have their shop, and there's so many shops. But when you come to a temple, there's a dome and a chakra on the top, correct? Or in the Christian world, there's a cross. Or in the Islam world, there's a crescent moon and a star. In the Jewish world, there's a star. Now, why is that on the top of the building? To dedicate that building in people's minds to the service of God. That you know that there are so many buildings with so many purposes, but this particular building, the only function of it is the worship of God. That is the only thing going on inside. So therefore, we have to know that our body is God's temple. God is within our heart. The question is, are we willing to accept the fact that he's there and worship him there? Or are we going to neglect him? So the putting on of this tilak, this clay on our foreheads, is to simply make a sign that this body is God's temple, and the only thing that this body is for, and the only thing taking place within this body, is the worship of God. Through whatever we do, whatever we think, and whatever we say, it is in the service and the glory of God. So if we accept that the body is a temple of God, we must keep the temple clean. That is proper respect. So through water, we cleanse the body. And the cleansing of the mind takes place through the process which is most readily available for all of chanting the name of God. It is described by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the great incarnation of Lord Krishna in this age. Cheto darapana marajanam bhava mahadavikni. He says that the mind is like a mirror. It is meant to reflect the glory and the effulgence of the soul and of God. Huh? Just like if you put a mirror to the sun, the mirror reflects the light of the sun. But if that mirror is full of dust and dirt, it cannot reflect anything. God is within our heart, but due to the dust and dirt, based on material conception, misconceptions, due to material attachments, it cannot reflect the glory of God within us. nor can we even perceive our real self through the mirror of our mind. When you look in a mirror, what do you expect to see? You expect to see you, huh? But if the mirror is covered by dirt, all you see is dirt. You are completely obscured. So our mind has to be cleansed. And the process of cleansing the mind is chanting the name of God. The name of God is all pure. The name of God is not different from God. And in every religious scripture in the world, the chanting of the name of God is not only recommended, but demanded. When we cleanse the dust from the mirror of our mind, then the true glory of the soul is revealed, not only to us, but to all others. It is explained in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Kalera dosani de rajan asti heka mahanguna kirtana eva krishnasya mukta sangha parambrajit. That in this age of chaos, of quarrel, and of hypocrisy that we're living, there is one great benediction, that anyone who simply chants the name of God attentively and sincerely, regularly, taking it like medicine, understand that we have a terminal disease which is called death. And there is a medicine that can cure that disease. And it is the name of God. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he was not a fanatic. He prayed to the Lord, Nam Nam Akari Bahuta Nija Sarva Shaktis Tatrapita Niyamitas Marane Nakala, that my dear Lord, you have many names. If you don't like the name Krishna, whatever name of God is authorized in your particular religion, chant that name. It is the medicine to cure you from the disease of death. Now, you will not take the medicine seriously unless you understand the gravity of the crisis that you're about to face. Just like a doctor. The duty of a doctor is he must convince the patient what a dangerous predicament he's in. Otherwise, the patient's not going to waste his time to buy the medicine and to take it. Correct? But if you understand the gravity of the situation, you will not miss that medicine, even one dose, for your life. So therefore, the chanting of the name of God must not be done whimsically. It must be done regularly, with attention, with care, with a philosophical and logical understanding why we are chanting the name of God, what are its effects, and why I absolutely need this medicine. Because you are eternal, and you're identifying yourself with a body that is about to die. The disease is ignorance. Ignorance of the truth that we are part of God. Just as God is the supreme eternal, we are eternal. Just as God is supremely full of knowledge, we are full of knowledge. And just as God is the reservoir of all pleasure, it is our nature to be always peaceful in every condition of life. That is our real nature. That is our healthy condition. So we have to take this medicine very seriously. And this is how we cleanse our body and our mind. The next principle of religion is mercy. How to be merciful within this society. Again, every religion of the world teaches that you must be merciful. And mercy is a, showing mercy is a sacrifice. It is an austerity. Mercy. Ahimsa. Mohandas Gandhi preached very strongly on this religious principle of ahimsa, or nonviolence. That is an act of mercy. as it is said in the Bible, do unto others as you would have them do to you. Huh? But I heard one great saint in the Himalayas, he once told me, better than that, do not do to others what you would not like them to do to you. That's more practical within our society today. Because mostly we're not doing what we would want. Mostly we're thinking in terms of doing bad things to others. So never do to another what you would not want them to do to you, whoever they are. And do unto others what you would want them to do to you. That is a basic principle of nonviolence. And, of course, Gandhi, he made a major contribution of dispatching the entire British Empire from India based on his faith in the strength of ahimsa, or nonviolence. And the whole world was simply watching in astonishment. Here we have the British Empire on one side. They had manipulated and exploited more of the world than any other empire in our modern history. They had millions of soldiers. They had the most incredibly sophisticated political plans and organizational policies. And here was one little skinny old man, and he conquered them. And India was the jewel of the British Empire. The British Empire was willing to give everything up, but not India. This is the power of nonviolence. But that nonviolence was based on faith in God. Faith can move mountains, what to speak of British empires. Huh? We must have faith. It is said in the Bible, Jesus said, if you have enough faith the size of a mustard seed, if you tell a mountain to move into the ocean, that mountain must move into the ocean. That is why it is said faith can move mountains. There is no power stronger than faith. And we must have faith that God will protect us if we are willing to protect what is His. Huh? Because according to the laws of karma, whatever you do must come back to you. If you cause harm to another human being, you will suffer that harm and you cannot escape. But factually, every living entity is a child of God. And the Vedic literatures teach that even the most insignificant animals have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, just as human beings do. And to interfere with their pursuit of happiness and to cause them unnecessary pain, you are responsible and liable to accept the same reaction upon yourself. Our Guru Maharaj used to say that you can judge a society's spirituality very simple. You just see how the cows are being treated. The cow is the mother for society. In every society, every baby practically is brought up on the milk of the cows. Now, when I was in my teenage years in America, the President of the United States, do you know how he made all his money to become rich and famous and ultimately become president? By slaughtering cows. He had a huge ranch in Texas. And under his name, he was making profits for hundreds and thousands of cows being killed. More than cows that he killed were his own children, because he's the father of the country, the president, correct? Who were sent to the Vietnam jungles to be slaughtered. The Vietnam jungles were like a slaughterhouse. And there were hundreds and thousands of innocent youths of America that he was sending to the slaughterhouse. According to the Shastra, this is the reaction. If you kill the cow, your children will be killed. And ultimately, you will be killed. Bloodshed breeds bloodshed. George Bernard Shaw, one great playwright, he explained that he was a Christian man, but he was a very, very thoughtful person. He said, every day you're praying, every day we go to church and we're praying, God, give us peace, give us peace, give us peace. And then we go home and we feast on a dead corpse. So mercy means to be considerate of the life, the liberty, and the pursuit of happiness of all living beings. Not to unnecessarily cause pain or death to anyone. This is a religious principle. And charity means, out of mercy for those who are in need, I will help them. It is the duty of the strong to protect the weak. This is a civilized society. It is the duty of the wealthy to maintain those who have no wealth. Now, you could make so many political arrangements by socialism, capitalism, communism, but this will never work. It will never be successful. Because in the communist countries, although they're trying to make everyone equal, everyone is still exploiting one another. Until there is the purification of the heart, until a person lives by these spiritual principles, there's no question of real mercy within society. And of course, what is the ultimate charity? The ultimate charity is to give the most precious thing to another, to give that person what he needs most. To give in food is very good charity. To give free medical assistance is wonderful charity. But again, we're still dealing with the symptoms of that person's suffering. But to give a person knowledge of the eternal nature of the soul, and to give a person the means by which, the direction by which he can attain that destination of eternal life, means you solve all that. Therefore, the topmost and most intimate act of charity or welfare work is to enlighten a person in one's spiritual heritage. And of course, just like you may not be a doctor, so you give money to the hospital where the doctors can utilize your donation for that purpose. With our words, we should try to enlighten others. Through our acts, our example in life, we should try to enlighten others. And through our wealth, we should give contribution to those compassionate spiritual doctors who know how to really give the true welfare of enlightenment to others. This is the highest charity. This is the highest mercy. And the fourth principle of religion is truthfulness. Now, of course, there are many gradations of realizations of what is real truthfulness. When I was a young boy, there was a very, very great story about George Washington that every child learns in school. You know who George Washington was? He was the first president of America. And the story is, when he was a little boy, his father gave him an axe. And he went into his father's garden, and there was a cherry tree. Very beautiful, his father's favorite cherry tree. And our little George cut down the cherry tree. You know this story? Famous story. My God, even in India you know this story. So the father asked, who cut down the cherry tree? And of course, George was holding the axe, so it wasn't like he was so honest. He said, Father, I cut down the cherry tree. And everyone is thinking, ah, just see, he was so truthful, he was so honest. This is the integrity of our first president of America. But what is truth? Simply to not tell lies in our practical daily affairs is important. We should be honest and straightforward in all of our dealings in this world, as far as possible. That is called morality. But Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that the definition of truth is to know that all living beings are part of me, and that they are in me, and that they are mine. The truth is that we are part of God, that everything is the property of God. Unless we know the truth, unless we understand the truth, how can we be truthful? Often we use this example that our Guru Maharaj used to often use. It is the example of honor amongst thieves. Huh? Let us say that in this room we all decide that we are going to rob all the money from the State Bank of India. Huh? So we make our very, very elaborate plans, and every person here has his specific duty. One person waits at the door, one person tries to divert the policeman outside, another person is standing with a walkie-talkie. So many, you know, robbers are very sophisticated, especially in New York City. My God, even the most insignificant robber on the street, he has such a sophisticated plan of how to get what he wants. Huh? So thieves are very, very intelligent. Actually, our Guru Maharaj said, in order to be a thief, you have to be one of the most intelligent and resourceful people of all occupations in society. Huh? A good thief. So, we have to understand if we're going to rob the State Bank of India, we have to be very intelligent and very resourceful. Okay, let's imagine we've done it. We have millions, crores of rupees, and we bring it back in this room. And then one of us stands up and says, now let us divide this money honestly. No cheating going on, no stealing. Huh? This is called honor amongst thieves. Now the police come in the door and they say everyone's under arrest. And you tell them, what do you mean? We're dividing it honestly. You may be dividing it honestly amongst yourselves, but factually, it all belongs to the State Bank of India. You're all going to jail. This is our situation in this world. We may be very charitable and honest in our ordinary dealings, but factually everything is the property of God. And if we're not using it according to His will, we are thieves. So real truthfulness has to be based on an understanding of the truth. The truth is, Sarva Loka Maheshwaram, everything is the property of God, and we are part of Him, and our natural function is that we are His eternal servants. To act on that capacity as the eternal servant of God, that is truth. To act on behalf of God in the service of others. Some people ask, why are you always talking about serving God? What about humanity? If you serve God, you will serve humanity to the utmost, because you will see God in the heart of everyone. You will not envy anyone. You will love everyone. You will feel for every living being. Whatever their caste, whatever their nationality, whatever their religion, whatever their species of life, you will see your beloved brother in the heart of every living being. That is compassion. We find in this world that the people who reach out on all levels, even the most physical levels, to help others, are generally the people who have faith and love for God. In Calcutta, Mother Teresa, she's just living on the streets with the poorest, most suffering, diseased people, because she sees God in their hearts. She's not just doing it as a profession, she's doing it out of love. So on all levels, we can really serve the society best if we understand the truth. And how? What is the process of understanding the truth? Through countless ages, the process has been given to hear from those who know the truth. In the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Sri Krishna describes Tadvidi pranipatena pariprasnena sevaya upadekshanti te jnanam jnaninastvata darshanaha. He says, if you want to know the truth, you have to approach a guru. Inquire from him submissively and render service to him. The self-realized soul can impart knowledge unto you because he has seen the truth. This is not just something that's within the Hindu tradition. In the Vedas, it is also explained, tad vijnanartham sugurum eva abhigacchet. That even in your study of the Vedas, without understanding it, through the guidance of one who knows the truth, a guru, you'll never understand the essence of your own religion. In the Bible, Jesus Christ, he said, those who have ears, you hear. You hear from me. The Christians, the only way they can understand the truth is because they heard from Lord Jesus, who is their guru. Muhammad spoke the truth. So in every religion we find the only means of understanding what is truth is by approaching saintly persons. And therefore it is said, sadhu sangha, sadhu sangha, sarva sastra koi, lava matra sadhu sangha, sarva siddhi hoy. There is no more precious and cherished gift that God gives us than the association of a saintly person. Because even a moment's association with a saintly person can open the doors to liberation for us. Mahatsevam dwaram ahurava moktes tamodwaram yoshita sangi sangam. By associating with sinful people, we become sinfully minded. Every one of us knows, if we have children, that the biggest concern is who the children associate with. Especially in today's society, my God. If your children are associating with children that take drugs, your child will take drugs, I guarantee it. If your children are associating with people who are smoking and drinking, they will smoke. Because you become what you associate with. If you associate with saintly persons, you will become a saintly person. If you hear from one who knows the truth, you will understand the truth. Maharaj Parikshit, he had 7 days to live. He was the king of the world. With all of his money, all of his power, and all of his influence, he could have done anything for his last 7 days, correct? But what did he choose to do? He chose to sit in the association of saintly persons and hear from them the truth. There is a story told by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to Sanatan Goswami about a hunter named Magrari. This man was so sinful from his very birth. He was born and raised to love bloodshed and to see others suffer. Some people are like that. It may be hard to imagine, but it is true. His father taught him to half kill animals very expertly, so for hours they would just scream in pain and ultimately they would die. So the great saint Narada Muni, he came wandering through the forest. And as he was wandering through the forest, he saw all these animals flapping in pain and crying and screaming. And he was with arrows in very strategic places in their body just to cause them torture. He was thinking, who could possibly be so cruel? And then his hunter came before him. And Narada Muni asked, do you know who has done this? And he was very proud. He said, ah, it was me. He said, I did it with my bow. For generations, our family has been carrying on this tradition. And there's no greater pleasure that I find in life than seeing that at my hands, other living entities are crying and screaming. Oh. So Narada Muni, he explained to him, do you know what the law of nature is? For every action, there is an equal corresponding reaction. And he explained to him the laws of karma. And he gave him a vision of the types of suffering he was going to have to accept. And Magrari the hunter became very fearful. And he said, please, what can I do to release myself from this horrible destiny that I have created for myself? Narada Muni said, first you break your bow. He said, but my bow, for all my life, this is my maintenance for my family, I'm providing for them. Narada Muni said, okay, I'll make you a deal. You go to your family and you ask them, you tell them about all the sufferings that's in store for you. Ask them if they're willing to share those sufferings with you. He went back. He told them exactly what kind of tortures they're going to have to go through in the future. He said, are you willing? You're willing to come with me, right? Because I've done it all for you. They said, no, no, we are not going with you for that. So he came back to Narada Muni. He said, it looks like I'm on my own to suffer. So Narada Muni said, break your bow. Ultimately, God is providing for everyone. If you become true, if you dedicate your life in pursuance of the truth, God will provide for you. You do not have to be sinful to maintain anything in this world if you have faith in God. You don't have to give up your occupation. You can be a businessman. You can be a doctor. You can be a lawyer. You can be a teacher. You can be a field worker, a farmer, an architect, an engineer, a stockbroker. You can be a housewife. You can be a sannyasi. Whatever your natural affinity is for occupation, you carry on, but perform your occupation on the basis of truth. Otherwise, your whole life is a lie. It is an illusion. So Narada Muni told him to break his bow, and he broke his bow. And he became a very great saintly person. Narada Muni taught him how to cleanse his mind by chanting the names of God. He taught him what the real goal of life was. He became such a celebrated saint that people came from all countries around to have his darshan and to hear from him. And one day Narada Muni came with one of his friends, Paravat Muni, to come back to that place. And as they were approaching, Magrari, this ex-hunter, he could see that my guru is coming. It is only by his mercy, it is only by the words that emanated from his lotus mouth that I have been purified. So he wanted to just offer his obeisances to him and greet him with love and affection. And as he was walking, he saw ants on the road. And he stopped. And he very carefully waited for them to pass and put a cloth to try to brush them away. And Parvat Muni looked at Narada Muni and said, this is the glory of a saint like you, that the most cruel-hearted, horrible killer, simply by hearing from you, he's not even willing to cause harm to an ant. Huh. The culture of India is most famous and most worshipped throughout the world for the saintly persons who have been born on this soil. This is the glory of India, the saints. People do not come to India for economic purposes. Millions of Indians go to the West because they want money. But Westerners come to India because they want to meet the sadhus, because they want spiritual knowledge. We have to know that our spiritual life depends on how much we're willing to humble ourselves and hear from saintly persons. Because without this process, we will never understand the truth. We must read the scriptures regularly. But we must read them under the guidance of self-realized souls. And through this process, as an austerity, as a sacrifice, it is described in Bhagavatam, Nasta praishya bhadreshu nityam bhagavati sevaya. Bhagavati uttama sloke bhaktir bhavati naishtiki. That by regularly hearing the message of God from Srimad Bhagavatam or from the scripture, and by regularly serving those persons who are living those teachings and hearing from them, then all the impurities in our heart are eradicated and the truth will shine like the sun at noon from within our own heart. And when that sun of truth illuminates our heart through our words, through our actions, through our every aspect of life, through our occupation, through our family, we can enlighten the world. We can reflect the illuminating truth of God in all directions. And that is the greatest service that we can render to human society. And through this process, we can find peace in this age of chaos. And we can also spread peace, real peace, not superficial, artificial, patchwork peace, but we can give real peace to others in this age of chaos. Because when you attain the platform of truth, loving devotion to God, you will find that there is no chaos anywhere. Om Purnam Adha Purnam Idam Purnat Purnam Udachyate. When you know God, you understand that He is perfect and complete, and everything emanating from Him is perfect and complete. It may appear inconceivable and impossible to imagine how the things in this world are going on perfect. But they are. The only imperfection is our vision. Our spiritual vision is cataract by ignorance. By understanding and pursuing the truth, we can remove that cataract and see how everything within our environment is perfect. How everything is the loving grace of God. Not simply through intellectual understanding, but we can experience from the core of our heart God's expression of love in every condition of life. This is real peace. And it is not intangible. It is not something impossible. It is as close as your own soul. But we're running in every other direction to find pleasure and peace. We simply have to redirect our priorities in life toward our soul and toward the service of God. By associating with saintly persons, by hearing the truth, we will learn how to practice these four principles of religion: austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness. Whether we are Christians, whether we are Muslims, whether we are Hindus, whether we are Jews, or whether we are Buddhists, whatever religion we may profess to be, there's no need to change your religion. Sanatan Dharma is the message taught in the Vedas. The Vedas do not teach Hinduism. The Vedas teach Sanatan Dharma. Hinduism is basically the modern understanding of Sanatan Dharma. But Sanatan Dharma means to understand that your eternal, essential, constitutional position in life is that you are the servant of God, and to engage in that loving service and to love Him. That is Sanatan Dharma. And every religion is teaching essentially Sanatan Dharma. When we can capture that realization within our heart, within our life, then we will be peaceful. Not only we will be peaceful in this age of chaos, we will not even see chaos. We will only see how I am the humble servant to help every living being come out of this illusion of chaos. It is all like a dream. Let us wake up. That is the greatest goal of life, to wake up out of this dream of chaos and understand our eternal glory and the eternal glory of God. Thank you very much. It's like we have a doctor. Now, what if somebody has cancer? And you say, my dear sir, you have cancer, and if you take the treatment right away, you can be saved from this disease. Otherwise, you're going to suffer and die. And you say, why are you so pessimistic? Why are you criticizing me? Is that pessimistic? It's realistic. You may be very happy now. You may be very healthy now, but the cancer is there. It's like sometimes people, they're very healthy. They just go for a regular checkup and they detect a disease that's about to kill them. But they're not suffering the symptoms of the disease yet, but it's coming. So when the doctor diagnoses that disease and tells this patient that this is the cure, but you have to be convinced that you have the disease, the patient says, no, this is pessimistic. Why are you talking pessimistic? Why don't you be positive? Just see, I'm young, I'm happy, I'm running, I'm doing athletics. Huh? The compassionate doctor doesn't care what the current state of health is. He's concerned with the future of his patient. Isn't that true? After all, people smoke cigarettes and drink alcohol. It feels good, do it. Is that what a doctor will tell you? No, he will tell you that you may get lung cancer, you may get heart disease. Stop doing it. Huh? So people are so intoxicated by the so-called pleasures of life, they do not understand that birth, old age, disease, and death are imminent, coming upon them. Huh? It's not pessimistic, it's realistic. Do you have to die or do not you have to die? Tell me. Will you die or will you not die? So you're being pessimistic too. Huh? Why are you calling me pessimistic? You're saying you have to die. You're very pessimistic. Rascal. This world is a pessimistic place, so be realistic. But for you to say, well, there's nothing more than death, that's really pessimistic. But God's devotees are telling you there's an alternative. There's eternal life. This is the greatest optimistic. Huh? When the ostrich is being chased by the tiger, and he runs as fast as he can, and he sees that the tiger is about to devour him, he digs a hole in the ground and puts his head in the ground and closes his eyes and thinks, ah, the tiger is gone. Now I'm safe. Is he safe? Isn't it said that ignorance is bliss? Right? Ignorance is very blissful. But knowledge in this world is very painful. Because you understand the predicament you're in. That ostrich is about to be devoured, whether he opens his eyes or closes his eyes. Whether he admits it or not. You are about to die if you admit it or not. Correct? You're about to grow old whether you admit it or not. That's not pessimistic. That's realistic. Because there is a cure.
there is a way you can eternally, once and for all, avoid it. You simply have to take the medicine. The medicine is there for you, and it works, guaranteed. Just take it, accept it. Accept the mercy of God as He is giving it. Huh? Follow these four principles of religion. And there will be no more death. You will simply watch this temporary frame go through its natural course, but you will be unaffected. Huh? It is described in Bhagavad Gita that a self-realized soul, his peace and happiness is like an ocean. The soul in itself is like an ocean of bliss, of happiness, of pleasure. Now in this world, there are so many pleasures coming and so many pains coming. Correct? Sometimes pain, sometimes pleasure, sometimes honor, sometimes dishonor, sometimes happiness, sometimes distress. Constantly. It is like rivers coming into the ocean. Do the rivers disturb the ocean? During the dry season, the river just trickles in. During the rainy season, there's just millions of gallons or liters of water coming at every second. The ocean is unaffected because the ocean has such depth in and of itself that the rivers, big or small, are insignificant in comparison. Now, for a puddle of water, anything that comes in disturbs the whole thing. Correct? If the peace and happiness that we're experiencing within is like a puddle of water, then when happiness comes, we're overjoyed. And when distress comes, we're just totally just drowned by the turbulence of the waves and we suffer. But if the peace within our own heart is like an ocean, then although we experience and understand what's taking place in this world, we're above it, we're beyond it. That is self-realization. That is your nature. And any human being who is not experiencing that nature is cheating his own self and cheating all others. Because it is our duty not only to experience that nature ourselves, but to share that great treasure with others. Lord Chaitanya explained, Bharata bhumite hoila manusya janma jara janma sarata kakari kara para upakar. That every person born in the land of Bharatvarsha or India, which is the land of Dharma, the land of religion, the land of the avatars and the saints, the heritage of people in India is so highly spiritual that it is the duty of the Indians to do para upakar, the highest welfare work for the world, by realizing the truth themselves and sharing it. Huh? Then we will be beyond all pessimism. We will be established in truth. Yes?
You said that we are going to grow old, disease, and get death. But how does chanting the holy name is going to conquer death?
Mm.
As devotees also, we are going to die one day.
Mm.
So how does chanting cause death?
First of all, devotees are not going to die, and atheists are not going to die. Huh? The only difference is devotees know that they're not going to die and atheists know that they are going to die. But they're not. The soul never dies. Na jayate mriyate va kadachin nayan bhutva bhavata vanabhuya ajo nitya shashvara yam purano na hanyate hanyamane saride. For the soul there is neither birth nor death, nor having once been does it ever cease to be. The soul is not slain when the body dies. It is described that the body is like a set of clothes for the self-realized soul. Death is no more than a change of garments. The conscious force within you is spiritual. Whether you're an atheist or a theist, whether you're a Hindu or a Muslim or a Buddhist or a Sikh or a Christian, the soul within you is eternal. Jesus Christ said in the Bible, "What is your gain if you gain the whole world but you lose your eternal soul?" people are so ignorant in our society that they put so much emphasis on gaining things of this world, and they're cheating themselves of eternal life. Huh? Spiritual life is the most practical way of life. People think that spirituality is impractical. It's for people who failed at everything else. It's the most practical, the most intelligent, because it's based on truth. Are you the body or are you the soul? If you are the body, then religion is totally impractical. But if you are the soul, then material life is totally impractical. So the question is, are you the body or are you the soul? If you're the body, then why at death everyone's crying? The body's still there. What's the difference between living body and dead body? There's no consciousness. Consciousness is not a composition of material elements. Consciousness is the energy which is emanating from something spiritual, the soul. Matter has no life until the soul enters into it. So it's very practical that you never have to die. I never have to die. It is just a question of realization of who you are. One who realizes never dies. One who does not realize is thinking and suffering death. Is there any questions? Yes.
Talking about truthfulness and integrity and dealing in our honesty and our dealing with the others, you said you added a phrase, as far as possible. Now, how far is the farthest that we can go? And where, I mean, there's a possibility of us rationalizing. So how much as far as possible is possible in the farthest for me? How do I know?
In ordinary business dealings, sometimes just to survive, the relative truths must sometimes be twisted. Correct? It's like our Guru Maharaj used to always tell us that every businessman will tell his customer, "For you, I make no profit. This is the best price. I'm losing money for you." But do you believe he's losing money? Would he lose money for you? Do you think he would sell anything for no profit? But he says like this because he has to support his family and he has so much competitors. He has to say something to convince you to buy it. So of course, as far as possible, we should not tell any type of untruths. But if it's absolutely necessary to maintain what we must maintain, we can sometimes twist relative truths if it is essential, but not to the point where it's based in greed. Not where we're trying to cheat another or harm another. Huh? If our intention is to cheat or to harm, or if what we say is causing harm to another living being, or cheating another living being, then it is sinful. Huh? But this is a relative truth. Sometimes out of necessity you have to say certain things. But you should understand there will be some reaction. Even if you say like that, out of necessity. Therefore it is described in the Vedas that one who is doing business or has a worldly occupation should give a percentage of that money to the propagation of God consciousness. By doing that, he cleanses whatever unavoidable reactions may be there. If they're avoidable, you must avoid it. But if they're unavoidable, then you can atone for that by giving a portion of that in the service of God. Are there any other questions?
So what is the credibility and veridity of full-time monk life in opposed to that?
It's not a question of against that. That is very good. That is philanthropic work. That is work in the mode of goodness. Work in the mode of goodness will give you very pleasing karmic reaction. It will elevate your consciousness. It will also purify your consciousness. So that work must be there, and that work should not be stopped. But if you do it in the consciousness of God consciousness, then that same work is not only perfectly philanthropic, but it's also perfectly spiritual. In other words, if you do that philanthropic work of giving medicine to the sick, but you're doing it with a understanding of the truth that you are the eternal servant of God, and you are doing it consciously in the service of God to help